we have passed laws that were later found to be unconstitutional, and that may certainly happen here.
State Republican lawmakers attempt to ban gun bans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 16th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the fiscal cliff deal erases a health care opportunity for Alaska.
We'll never know whether or not it could have had an impact on price, quality, or access of health care in our state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
President Barack Obama today signed off on nearly two dozen executive orders meant to curb gun violence. Those orders launch a gun ownership safety campaign, require the Centers for Disease Control to examine the causes of gun violence, and call for law enforcement officials to receive better training for active shooter scenarios. He also called on Congress to pass a ban on assault weapons. But Alaska lawmakers today introduced a bill that would circumvent any stronger gun control measures. The Alaska Firearms Freedom Act would make it a crime to enforce any federal prohibitions on things like assault rifles and high-capacity gun magazines. A previous version of the bill already passed the House in 2010, and similar legislation is being introduced in states like Texas and Wyoming. But whether a ban on federal gun control measures would even be legal is in serious doubt. Adam Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA and the author of the book Gunfight. He says that under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, the federal government could just choose to ignore the Alaska law if it passes.
It is an open and shut case. Similar Firearms Freedoms Acts have been passed in states, and they have smartly not enforce those laws in those states because the federal courts would strike them down in a New York minute.
House Speaker Mike Chenault is sponsoring the bill. He says that it sends a strong message about federal overreach, and he knows that the courts could find the bill to be unconstitutional.
It certainly could be. You know, and we'll see where it ends up at the end of the day. We have passed laws similar to this before. Not this particular issue, but we have passed laws that were later found to be unconstitutional, and that may certainly happen here. But that doesn't mean that it's any less important than a number of other bills.
The bill to ban gun bans isn't the only piece of legislation related to gun control that's been filed. Representative Bob Lynn, a Republican from Anchorage, introduced legislation on Friday that would create a process by which teachers could carry guns in schools if they've undergone training and possess a permit. It appears that the bill may actually be more restrictive than current law, and it has been sent back to the state's Legal Services Division for review. A group of health reform advocates went through heroic efforts to meet the deadline for applying for an innovative program under the Affordable Care Act. They were hoping to start what's called a health cooperative in Alaska, an organization that would offer an alternative to buying insurance from the major carriers. But a day after the application was submitted, the fiscal cliff deal in Washington erased all new funding for the program. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The last 3 months were busy for Richard Miltenberger. The benefits consultant stayed up late, worked Saturdays, and ignored some of his regular work responsibilities to help Alaska and four other western states submit applications for federal health cooperative loans by the December 31st deadline. He sums up the amount of time he spent on the project this way.
An embarrassing amount.
When the 400-page applications were finally complete and in the hands of FedEx, the plane broke down in Memphis. A colleague of Miltenberger's had been tracking the packages and was up all night making phone calls.
All the way up the food chain, had somebody get on the plane, get the package off at Memphis, put on a non-Federal Express airplane to get it to D.C. overnight.
He calls the episode comical, but for Milton Berger, the stakes were high. He spent the last 2 years living and breathing health insurance cooperatives. In 2011, he helped Montana file the first health cooperative application under the new health reform law. As a former insurance executive, he immediately saw the appeal of a consumer-owned health plan.
You know, it's very hard to change an existing insurance company. I've been there before, and it's like trying to steer a battleship. It's very hard to change. But if you're starting fresh, you can really do some innovative things.
Health co-ops are nonprofit health insurance companies governed by members. They work with hospitals and medical providers to make sure patients get the best and most cost-effective care. Milton Berger got so excited about the idea, he helped launch the National Alliance of State Health Cooperatives to encourage other states to apply for the federal loans.
And I think we have, in Alaska, probably the best case of any state to start a health cooperative. It's absolutely needed there.
That's because Alaska has high health care costs and limited insurance options. So last fall, with the final deadline for health cooperative applications looming, Milton Berger called up someone he thought could help.
Hi, my name's Lon Wilson. I'm president of the Wilson Agency, located here in Anchorage, Alaska.
Wilson runs an employee benefits company and knows the ins and outs of the health insurance industry in Alaska. And it didn't take long for Milton Berger to convince Wilson that a health cooperative could be one answer to the high cost of health insurance in Alaska.
A new entity, a new venture that's not saddled with legacy costs and high overhead really has an opportunity to kind of come out of the box with something that really could be transformative in our community and really appeal to a certain segment of our population.
So the pair spent 3 months working on the application. They had to incorporate a nonprofit, do a feasibility study, and collect 24 letters of support. Wilson also had to recruit a board of directors. He says he didn't have trouble finding people in Alaska who were excited about the idea.
Healthcare, as we all know, it's all local, right? And having a plan that is formed in Alaska, run by Alaskans, directed by Alaskans for the benefit of Alaskans, in my opinion, is a good thing. It's an alternative. It's not for everybody, but it would be just one more alternative in a small market that has limited choice.
But as it stands now, Alaska won't get the chance to see if a health cooperative could have worked. The state's application miraculously made it to Washington, D.C. on December 31st. But Wilson says the celebrating was short-lived.
Well, the very next day, we learned of the fiscal cliff compromise, if you will, that was passed by the Senate.
The fiscal cliff deal eliminated all funding for health cooperatives that had not yet been approved. That means 24 states will have cooperatives, but 26 states, including Alaska, will not. Milton Berger had to read an email explaining the news 3 times before he could believe it.
Incredibly disheartening. I mean, almost to the point of tears for me.
Lon Wilson in Alaska took the news a little better, but he thinks that the last-minute deal sets up an unequal situation, with about half the states getting a chance to test health co-ops and half left out. Wilson says it's disappointing.
Without the application even being reviewed, without the opportunity for funding, we'll never know whether or not it could have had an impact on price, quality, or access of health care in our state. And that's the unfortunate part about this.
Milton Berger and Wilson aren't giving up, though. They've already been in touch with members of Congress trying to get the funding restored. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a story with a happy ending, finding a dog that fell 35 feet into a hidden well.
The sound was traveling around under the building, and he finally realized that she was barking and the sound was going up into the floor joists and traveling that way.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, supporting the Clare House Replacement Project. There's more information online at csssalaska.org.
The head of the American Gas Association predicts a modest uptick in the price of natural gas this year. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's unlikely to have an effect on a proposed Alaska pipeline.
There has been a spate of recent reports about the incredible growth in the U.S. oil and gas sector. Here's just one tidbit Jack Girard boasted at an oil and gas symposium in Washington Wednesday afternoon. He's the head of the American Petroleum Institute.
Recently, the International Energy Agency reports that the United States is now on track to surpass Saudi Arabia as the global leader in oil production and will do so by 2020. 7 short years.
And it's not just oil. The advances in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling have led to an abundance of natural gas in the lower 48. Congressman-turned-lobbyist Dave McCurdy heads the American Gas Association. He says that as the economy picks up, so will the depressed price of natural gas, though he expects it to be slow and steady and not a spike. Right now, it's about $3.40 for a million BTUs.
I would be surprised to see $4 before the end of the year.
If producers were to build a pipeline from the North Slope to Tidewater, the liquefied natural gas would be exported to Asia, not the lower 48. Larry Pursley says it's possible a price increase in natural gas from the continental U.S. could have an unrelated effect on Alaska, albeit several years from now. Pursley is the federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. He says Alaska's competition would be the proposed export terminals on the Gulf Coast.
If those plants have to pay significantly higher prices to buy North American gas to liquefy, put in a tanker and send to Asia, that's going to drive up the price of their commodity in Asia, which could help us because we're not connected to lower 48 pricing.
The Department of Energy is considering about a dozen Gulf Coast permit applications. One facility, owned by Cheniere Energy, is already under construction, but the earliest gas could be exported from there is the end of 2015. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The state is reviewing proposals for liquefying North Slope gas, trucking it to Fairbanks, and distributing it to consumers. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority last month solicited letters of interest in the project, and agency spokesman Karsten Rodvik says they received 16 replies by a January 8th deadline.
These responses came from a variety of organizations. They involve proposals that range from specific services to full turnkey operation.
ADA is involved in the gas trucking project as a potential conduit for low-interest state financing. The governor's proposed budget includes a $50 million grant and over $200 million more in bonds and loans for a project. The letters of interest include proposals from Fairbanks Natural Gas and Golden Valley Electric. Fairbanks Natural Gas currently trucks LNG from Cook Inlet and distributes gas to over 1,000 Fairbanks customers through a limited local piping network. FNG President Dan Britton says his company's North Slope gas plan is all-inclusive.
The liquefaction plant on the North Slope, transportation of the LNG and the propane, storage and vaporization, and distribution throughout the Fairbanks North Star borough, including North Pole.
Britton says a 3% interest rate on state loans proposed for the project by the governor would lower the gas price paid by consumers to the equivalent of below $2 a gallon fuel oil. Golden Valley Electric's proposal targets a similar price for gas. ADA's Rodvik says the proposals from FNG, Golden Valley, and others are being evaluated with three goals in mind.
Provide the lowest cost energy to the most interior Alaska consumers as soon as possible.
Rodvik says ADA plans to release a report on the proposals sometime next month. This week in Anchorage, the Alaska Board of Fisheries will consider 70 Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim fishery proposals. One proposal of special interest to the Kuskokwim looks to update the river's salmon management plan, including making some changes to the king salmon fishery. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Subsistence is by far the most important fishery on the Kuskokwim River, particularly the Chinook or king salmon fishery. Approximately 1,000 households in 26 communities along the river catch kings to eat. In the last few decades, harvests were about 80 to 100,000 kings per year. In a proposal to the Board of Fisheries, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game seeks a new management plan for king salmon to help rebuild the weak returns. It includes 62 pages of strategies and looks to lower escapement goals on some rivers. In recent years, subsistence restrictions were implemented because managers believed escapement goals could not be met. But following a new method for calculating salmon populations, those restrictions could be prevented, according to Travis Ellison, Kuskokwim area management biologist for the state. He says the proposed plan is an accumulation of 10 years of collaborative research.
One of the major things that came out of that indicated that the established goals, which were based on completely different methods, that they're overly conservative.
New data shows that a larger king return comes from years with smaller sized escapements. So it doesn't necessarily pay off to restrict subsistence to have more salmon returning to Kuskokwim tributaries.
The underlying premise behind that is there's density dependent factors, so there's competition.
In other words, there are too many salmon fry competing for the same food. The new State Department plan would revise the escapement goals on particular tributary rivers, lowering goals in three rivers and eliminating them altogether in one. According to Fish and Game, the Tuliksac River, located about 50 miles upriver of Bethel, has been extensively altered by mining activity and supports only a small number of Chinook salmon. The Nyack Gold Mine had been formerly operated there. The state proposes to discontinue the escapement goal for the Tuliksac, but still monitor it and manage it as necessary. But ending escapement goals on the Tuliksac is one of a few sticking points the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has with the state's new plan. In a letter to the Board of Fisheries, Pete Probrasco, Assistant Regional Director of the Office of Subsistence Management, says that although mining has damaged the Tuliksac's habitat, the system should still be able to support more kings than have been returning there. The Federal Service says it will be more difficult for them to manage the king run without the Tuliksac escapement goal in place. Another concern that federal managers have with the plan is they think the state's total run estimates are too low. They say the subsistence harvests are likely underreported and that the mark recapture estimates used to scale run reconstruction are too low. The Federal Service says they would like to delay escapement goal revisions until those concerns are more fully explored and addressed. However, the Federal Service agrees with most of the state's management proposal. The Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents 56 tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, has concerns with the state's proposed plan as well. Myron Nanning is AVCP president.
We have concerns about the lowering of biological escapement goals being proposed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for the Kuskokwim River because of what we have seen.
Nanning says they've watched salmon runs diminish in the Norton Sound area and on the Yukon River, and they're critical of the state's new method to gather population data on the Kuskokwim. Nanning and other AVCP staff plan on testifying at this week's Board of Fish meeting in Anchorage. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years from executive and technical placement to medical and office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active three times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Juneau's Ruben Yost is the new chief of the state ferry system. Transportation Commissioner Pat Kemp named the longtime department employee to the deputy commissioner post on Tuesday. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Yost will be in charge of the marine highway system, but he'll also oversee measurement standards, commercial vehicle enforcement, and a variety of special projects.
Commissioner Kemp envisions having three deputies that have areas of responsibility but aren't limited to just one area.
Yost says the structural changes will shift some responsibilities to Marine Highway General Manager John Falvey, who's been in that position about 8 years. One big job for both is to oversee design of the Alaska-class ferry. Governor Sean Parnell last month announced two smaller shuttle ships will be built with existing funds. Earlier plans called for one larger ship. Yost says he will also work to fund and design other new ships for Southwest and Southeast service.
The Tustamina is in need of replacement, and so are some of the original mainliners. And that's an aspect that people really haven't focused on with the Alaska-class ferry.
Yost replaces Mike Neusel, who was in charge of just the ferry system for about 2 years. Several predecessors also had that single focus. Yost has been overseeing a number of transportation efforts, including the Juneau Access Project. That would build a road north out of Juneau to a shuttle ferry terminal across Lynn Canal from Haines. Yost began his 18-year state career as an environmental analyst and manager. More recently, he's been Southeast Regional Director of Construction, Maintenance, and Operations. This is Ed Schoenfeldt, reporting from Wrangell.
A Yakutat family is counting its blessings after nearly losing one of its own during the January 4th earthquake. KCAW's Anne Bryce has the story.
On the afternoon of Friday, January 4th, 9-year-old Tana went on a walk in Yakutat, like she did most days. When she didn't come home that evening, the family wasn't really worried.
I went out that night looking for her, but I didn't see her anywhere, so I figured she's maybe visiting somebody, you know?
Tana is a dog, a pit bull blue heeler mix, and her name means copper in Tlingit. Her owner, Ron Bowler, says she often visits apartments around the town's community center. Hours later, she always returns home, sometimes even too full to eat her own dinner. A little before midnight, a 7.5 magnitude earthquake shook southeast Alaska. Tana was still nowhere to be found. Bowler thought she might have sensed the tremor and went to hide someplace. So the family waited, hoping she'd turn up after the excitement died down. Tana has a special place in Bowler's heart. After his mother died, his son gave him the dog to help him heal from the devastating loss. He says Tana was the one who helped him recover from his deep depression. The next evening, when Tana was still missing, Bowler became really worried. He thought maybe the worst had happened. She'd been attacked by wolves or hit by a car and left on the side of the road. But at 8 o'clock, a neighbor called Bowler and told him another person heard a distant barking by her house under a building.
So my son ran down there, and there was a door there open underneath the building, and he called the dog, and she barked. He heard her barking, and so it sounded like it was coming from the corner, so he flashed the light over there, and there was nothing there. So he called her again, and she barked again, and it sounded like it was coming from the other corner. And he flashed the light over there, and nothing was there. And it kept going like this for a few minutes. The sound was traveling around under the building, and he finally realized that she was barking and the sound was going up into the floor joists and traveling that way.
Then he saw an old abandoned well about 4 feet across and 35 feet deep.
And my son looked down there, and there was our dog.
Within minutes, they had a 12-person rescue team on the job. The crew lowered Bowler's son, JP, down into the well to fetch the family dog.
When he got down in there, he was standing in water that was waist deep. So the poor dog had been standing on her hind legs for at least 24 hours in that well, trying to keep herself alive.
After they raised Tana up, they heaped warm blankets on her and huddled around. Her nails were scraped down and bloody, and she caught a case of Giardia, an infection caused by a parasite found in dirty water. But all in all, she's in good shape now. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
Two donors have sent hundreds of thousands of dollars each to improve a couple of buildings in Sitka. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Kettleson Memorial Library Director Sarah Bell got a phone call just before Christmas.
They said, "We are people who don't shop at fancy stores. I won't include any brand names, but we aren't people who have money. We're not even sure how to give this away, but this is what we are thrilled to have discovered, that we have this money to give."
The "we" Bell is talking about are members of the John J. and Eleanor A. Bruce family, and what they had to give was $400,000.
We all say, "Oh boy, if I got a bunch of money, I'd write a great big check." I wonder how many of us would do that.
The money will be used to help fund the library's expansion. The building is set to grow by about 60%. John Bruce worked in Alaska during World War II. He helped build the Alcan Highway. His wife, Eleanor, became a librarian in her mid-40s and retired just before age 81.
So when they heard about the library expansion program here, they decided that their contribution in a larger city wouldn't be as significant, but here it makes a huge difference for us.
Just how much of a difference? Well, here's some math. The project is expected to cost about $6.2 million. The library already has about $5.7 million from the state, so that leaves a $500,000 for the city-run library to raise. This donation gets them 80% of the way there. That's 80%. The library's expansion will include a larger area for children, a new section for young adults, along with meeting rooms, computer facilities, and a historical document research area. The project is due to begin sometime this year. But here's the thing. The library is not the only Sitka organization to receive a big check in the last few days. The Sitka Sound Science Center just received $200,000 to help improve the Sage Building, where its operations are based.
It's a big deal.
Lisa Bush is executive director of the Science Center.
We're thrilled on several levels. One, it's really going to help us move forward in getting this first phase funded and done. So we're really excited about that. And then we're thrilled to have the support of DIPAC.
DIPAC stands for Douglas Island Pink and Chum Incorporated. It's the Juneau-based fisheries enhancement organization that wrote the check. Bush says the organization represents a wide swath of the commercial fishing industry and that its donation is a vote of confidence in the work being done at the Science Center that includes hatchery operations, research, and aquaculture training programs. Specifically, the $200,000 will support the first phase of a three-phase renovation.
I would call this phase one kind of the very basic, building function stage, because, if you don't have a working roof and you're bleeding money with heat leaving the windows and that sort of thing, then you can't go much further.
The total renovation of the Sage Building is expected to cost almost $4 million. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Wrangell, and Dan Bryce and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fei. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.